Dargraith Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 11, delivered on July 8, 2014. The title of this lecture is Labor, Unions, and Labor Law.
Tonight, labor, unions, and labor law. In the early decades of this country's existence, the working conditions for the typical urban laborer were pretty bad. There was a great influx of workers to the cities in the north because of all of the jobs that were there. And many of them were immigrants, and they would just come into the country and go to work in the big, huge factories that were coming up as a result of the Industrial Revolution. And the working conditions were, by standards of today, just unconscionable. It was hot. It was miserable. The equipment was massive and dangerous. The hours were extraordinarily long. The pay was wretched. And essentially, where we are today, it was built on the backs of those millions of workers in those factories and on the farms, too, in those early days of the country. There were organizations that were popping up before the Civil War, attempting to collectivize workers so that they could negotiate for conditions and pay and all of that. They had some success in getting some workers together in certain cities. In fact, in some cities, there were even publications, sort of like newspapers, that were labor-oriented. These for lack of a better term, I'll call them craft unions. The craft unions were rough, tumble people, men mostly, and they were also had some political turn to them too. They would criticize politicians sometimes, and then they'd get in trouble and have their newspapers shut down and all that. And they would attempt to get some of their candidates in some places elected to office, labor candidates. This was in the pre-Civil War period. It really never took hold in a major national sweeping way. In fact, one effort to essentially bring together all of the craft unions, all of the workers, under a national banner failed. It failed. It just didn't get anywhere. That was the pre-Civil War period. Now, once you get to the Civil War itself, and I brought this up a little bit before, there was a serious discontent among workers, among the common people, with conditions that they lived under. Certainly, the Civil War had its ups and downs for both the North and the South. But the one thing that was evident was a growing discontent among workers, especially the immigrants in the big cities, because essentially it was their kids who were going off to fight Mr. Lincoln's war. Gather them up and send them off to battle. At first, there was no conscription, but conscription came, and then there were all of these exemptions that the rich people could get for their kids. You could pay $300, and then you didn't have to have your kid fight. Or you could hire someone to fight in your kid's stead in the Civil War. Well, the $300 payoff kind of got so unpopular they dropped that, but the pay for a proxy in battle was still quite popular with the rich. They'd hire a poor kid to replace their precious rich kid and all of that. And the immigrants in the cities knew that they were being screwed. The work that they did was awful, and their kids were being sent off to the utter slaughterhouse of the Civil War. And there were riots. One was, interestingly enough, depicted without much context, but it was depicted rather well in the movie Gangs of New York. Did any of you ever see that movie? If you get a chance, you'll see a riot, and they don't exactly explain what's going on in this riot in New York City. But that was an anti-draft, anti-big business riot by the immigrants in the city. It began like a lot of those kinds of riots do. Just one day, something snapped in the people. The men started pouring out into the streets. Now, New York City, back at that time, was almost like a weird place. There were these, much of it was like a Wild West kind of place. Then there was this kind of like apocalyptic, not countryside, not urban, large areas. And then there was the places where the rich people lived. They had their rich people's stores and shops. The immigrants started flowing through the alleys and into the heavier streets. And on they went toward where the rich people were, toward the nice places in town. They were going to tear them up. They were going to pillage them. They were going to just be angry. As they gathered, more and more of them rolling forward in the bigger and bigger streets, in the nicer streets, as you get towards the rich people's houses and shops. They were breaking windows in shops. They were looting the stores. They were destroying, burning everything in their path, running down the streets, gathering force. And then they turned down one street, a huge number of them, packed all together. And when they turned down that street, there were the federal soldiers lined up with their muskets, leveled and ready. And there was no place to go. And the soldiers opened fire. Now, if you've ever seen a Civil War bullet, if you will, they're big chunks of metal or ceramic. And they just plunk, plunk, plunk through one person after another. The people were just packed, turned into just essentially mania, trying to get away from the hell that was in front of them with the soldiers stacked, one on their knees, one crouched, one standing, all the way across this wide street, just firing and firing. One bullet would rip a couple of arms off until it stopped in the chest cavity of someone, one after the other. Blood everywhere, just incredible amounts of blood, screaming, cussing, swearing. The smoke was so thick because it was confined in the street that you couldn't even see your own body, whether you'd been shot or what. That's how we treated workers when they got mad, when they'd had enough, when they were treated like the cannon fodder that they were to the rich people of that era. That was Mr. Lincoln's army. You get past the Civil War, and industrial America was on a roll. The North had won. They had kicked the ass of the South. And it was all about how, oh, it was just a matter of fighting slavery. Bullshit. The North had been dominating the South, controlling it. The banksters in the North funded the misery in the South. And then the South couldn't sell its produce except through the powers of the North, their ships, their money, their trade routes, their connections. It was a mess for the South, and it was poor, but the North was rolling, and the factories were getting bigger, and they were spewing their smoke into the air, taking over one city block after another with the factories and all of that. And the workers were struggling. They suffered under this regime. Now, at the end of this course, I'm going to give you a lecture on leftist economics, arguably brought into consideration as a viable political social model by a German named Karl Marx, who had written a series of treatises, books, if you will, papers, calling for the workers of the world to unite. Don't keep believing these people when they say times will get better. They won't. They are taking what you do and they are becoming rich off what is the sweat of your brow, the stain of your blood, the burning of your tears. Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. Unionize. Fight. And finally overthrow this capitalist system that everyone tells you is right, and you know damn well it's not, because you're suffering under it. Well, this took hold in many countries, at least to a certain extent, and some more than others. It became the fancy of American academics, certainly, in the universities, the people like me, the long-haired, bearded radicals. It did have a resonance among workers. You know, what are we supposed to do? Just keep doing this for the rest of our miserable short lives, watching ourselves having all that we do taken away from us to enrich these rich people, and then we're handed a subsistence wage, and this is going to be the lot of our children? It already is the lot of our children. Our children are working in these factories. Our women are working in these factories. Our women are being treated like sex cattle in these factories and these offices. And we're being treated like animals. So arose a union type of expression of this communist view. It was called the Knights of Labor. Now, this was after the Civil War. The Knights of Labor began to organize. It was not a union. It was a labor movement. Make sure you understand that. It never achieved the status of a true union. Although in maybe the early 1870s, maybe even into the early 1880s, it had followers. It had those who said, yeah, I see your point. Well, the Knights of Labor followed the advice and followed the prescriptions of Karl Marx. It was a socialist movement. Now, they were awfully, awfully radical in their demands, their labor demands. I mean, these things were just ridiculous. I mean, 8-hour work days. Equal pay for men and women. Jesus. I mean, these communist pigs. Imagine that. A safe working environment where people aren't killed. As you can see, it's just completely ridiculous radicalism. Damn leftists. The Knights of Labor never really got a true hold in the American labor, in American labor. There was something about socialism, then as now, that kind of chafes against the common person's, the common American's way of thinking. Now, we don't want to take away the capitalist's pie. We would rather have a system where we get our fair share of the pie. That, and the Knights of Labor said, take the pie away from them, equally distribute, socialist. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Well, we had tried socialist models in this country even before there was a country in the 1600s. more than a few towns tried to organize themselves on a socialist model. Everyone works and everyone gets food. Every one of those towns that followed that model finally abandoned it because it just didn't work. It wasn't the way we do things, apparently. And so every time you see this socialist model come back around, too heavy, too hard, you're going to see something that's not what we want to do. So the Knights of Labor never really got fully underway to the point where it was a union. Again, it was just a labor movement. But it was still enough that it got the attention of the big capitalists. And it got the attention of workers themselves. Even though it might have been going too far in this take the pie away from the industrialist model, it was still the first warning shot that something big was going to come. That something big would come in the form of a splinter group that came off the Knights of Labor. The splinter group was led by a man named Samuel Gompers. As a matter of fact, if I understand it, there is actually a school up in Joliet that is named after Samuel Gompers, famous man in the labor movement. Still hated to this day by bigwig capitalists. Samuel Gompers broke off with his crew from the Knights of Labor and established the first true union in America, the American Federation of Labor. The American Federation of Labor, the AFL, was quite a thing. The American Federation of Labor, 1888, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken. Trying to think, am I right on that? 1888, yeah. Or 1886, I'll check that date for you. But American Federation of Labor, AFL. Now, they actually had some of the same positions as the Knights of Labor. But they didn't want to go so far that they were interested in just destroying the industrialists and the capitalists. They wanted to collectively bargain. In other words, we're going to get together with our boys, and we're going to come up and we're going to deal with your boys. And we're going to come to an agreement on how much you pay us, what our working conditions are. We're not out to kill you, you're not, and we're going to make sure you're not going to destroy us, but we are going to collectively bargain. As a group, as a single body, labor will negotiate with the capitalists, with the business owners. Now, as I've told you before in this course, this is not the only time, this is certainly one of the times, but it's not the only time in American history when our government was the best government money could buy. Most of the history of the United States has been a history of control of the political process by very wealthy, powerful people. That's just the reality of it. The ideal of a democracy, one man, one vote, the common people run the country, bullshit. And in this era I'm talking about here, in the late 1800s, it was a heyday of power arising from money. From the local alderman all the way up to the president, it was a government that was bought and paid for. From the legislators to the judges and the other instrumentalities of government, the law enforcement community, it was not going to put up with this labor movement. Let the head knocking begin. Strike was met with laws, judges threw labor organizers in prison. There were horrible battles of strikers against the police, federal troops, and these private thug organizations like Pinkertons that was around back then, nothing but for the purpose of protecting the interests of the rich. You wanted to have a strike? You were out there demonstrating, picketing? Well, you are going to have a whole bunch of horse carts come up and a whole lot of people with chains and bottles and iron stuff. We're going to knock heads with you. What you have, Your worker rights were not given to you by politicians. They were earned for you by Irishmen and Scotsmen and Englishmen and Germans who went head to head and knocked heads with those government and private interests. The stories are heroic and ugly. I'm not giving you a pretty, I don't want to give you the impression that the union movements were pretty. They were not. The organizations were corrupt. The men were ugly, brutal, and violent, because what they were coming up against was ugly, brutal, and violent. And what they were coming up against was a lot bigger than they were, because it was included the federal government, which was on the side of the businesses. But it kept going. Somehow, one of the things that you find out in history is that wherever you look in the world, when the great come rolling in to conquer the small, to provide them with what they need, no trouble, we'll give you our ways, our promises, whatever, people don't take it. The Romans faced people, faced just little ragtag bands. All you have to do is pledge to us, Romans. Why are you going to die fighting us? But all over the world, over and over again, that's what happens. And that was the way it was with the early labor movement. Why don't you just back down? Stop these fantasies about collective bargaining and all these pipe dreams about better wages, and just let us run the show, us rich people. But somehow we just didn't want to do it, even though we got our asses kicked. Over and over again, we got our asses kicked. And it still happens to this day. I had a couple of head-knocking experiences in my early union days. Into the 20th century, collective bargaining was illegal in most places, and you couldn't organize unions. You couldn't get together and have a meeting. You could end up in prison for it. You could end up, if that wasn't good enough, you could end up having your house blown up, your kids killed, your wife raped and dead, your animals hung on your door. That was how rough it was back then. But we still kept going. There was an interesting turn, and I'd mentioned this in the last lecture or a lecture before that, maybe, that around the time of World War I, what was called at the time the Great War, there was a turn away from conservative, pro-business, right-wing politics in this country. It didn't last very long, but it was spearheaded by a president who was probably the first true modern liberal president, Woodrow Wilson, who had his flaws, but he had a lot of ideals, and one of them was, we're going to no longer provide federal help for local labor disputes. In other words, big business, don't come crying to us for federal troops if you want to bust a union that's starting, bust a local chapter that's starting up. And no, local police, we're not going to come to your aid if you get your asses kicked in a fight with the strikers. Interesting little turn. And that was all it took for union membership to begin to expand very quickly. In other words, people realize, maybe I won't get my house burned down. It becomes safer to be a part of the labor movement. This was in like 1914, 1918 period. Well, that era, that brief liberal era, kind of vanished. And we had a succession of three pro-business presidents who went right back to the old anti-union philosophy. You don't benefit the society by protecting labor unions. They're probably a bunch of reds. They're promoting communism. Look at what the Knights of Labor were doing. You stop big business from getting bigger. They are the ones who, they are the job creators. We need to cut their taxes because they're the ones whose capital stimulates investment, which stimulates more jobs, which stimulates the growth of our country. We need to not be providing welfare because, people should work. People are lazy. If they can't find a job, Giving them money and food just encourages them not to find a job. Sound familiar? This is 1918 up to the beginning of the 1930s. The union busting was, union membership collapsed again because essentially it was dangerous to be even seen with a union organizer. But funny thing about history, though, another funny thing I'll bring up, is that people will put up with a lot of crap. People are actually surprisingly tolerant. You can kick people around for a long time before they finally have had enough. Way past when you think, oh, people are going to really rebel now. No, they just keep letting it happen. They let this pro-business era go on. It was pretty obvious by the mid-20s and even into the later 20s that there was something really wrong. The rich were getting so much richer. I mean, they were living high on the hog. This was the roaring 20s for them. But everyone else, people who had lived in the middle class, who had worked their way up, they were starting to be poor. Banks were collapsing. People were losing their money, their life savings. Now, out in this part of the country, we didn't feel it so much. We were quite self-sufficient. But even out here, we began to feel, times are bad. And really, they're treating people pretty awful. Everyone's suffering. Except for them rich people up there on Wall Street and the big banks and all that. Here they're having a good time there in New York. Did you see that picture of that Tiffany lamp in the newspaper? Boy, someone bought that. The way it works is that people will put up with difficulties a long time after they probably should start saying enough is enough. And what it takes, usually, oftentimes in history, is something like a flashpoint, like a straw that broke the camel's back, or like a touchstone, before people will finally have had enough. And it's usually something that is so remote from them that they really probably, they could ignore it, but for some reason, that's what makes the world snap and say enough. One time when this happened, one of my favorite places to go to spend time is up in the Dakotas. Up there, Wounded Knee is an incredible place. It's a spiritual place. You go up there to the chapel at the top of the hill, and in the summer, you've got temperatures in the 120s, wind at 45 miles an hour, dry heat. And as much as I'm not a spiritualist kind of person, that's where you go to cleanse your soul, I think. You know the story of Wounded Knee? Do you know what happened at Wounded Knee? Funny they don't teach that to you guys anymore. Well, you see, we were pushing the Lakota and the Oglala Sioux out of their native lands. We were going to move them out, get rid of them. It was the later 1800s. We were clearing the land for the settlers and the manifest destiny of the Euros, the Europeans. And so we had gathered up the Indians, as they call them, Injuns, and we had essentially engaged them in a forced march. They were going to walk the many, 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 many miles to the reservation where we were going to put them. In violation of a previous treaty. Federal troops herded them and they marched them. Day after day they were walking, and in the area of South Dakota there was a place called Wounded Knee in the local traditions. And that was where they stopped for the night, and all of the Native Americans encamped with the federal troops off some ways away on the rolling hills, just to keep an eye on them. Well, some of the hothead young Sioux, as you call it, they said, "We have to fight this. We have a story. There's a dance called the Ghost Dance. And if we do this dance, our ancestors will come from the sky and they will drive away our enemies. And so they started doing the ghost dance. A few shaman were there overseeing it, showing them how it was done, I guess. And they started dancing by the fire, the ghost dance. Well, the federal troops saw this. And apparently, the rumor got started that this was something like the preparation for an attack. And at some point, the federal troops moved in and just opened fire in the early morning. Scattered all of the Native Americans. They ran up down this long hill up towards the Wounded Knee, up towards where the chapel is now. They were running up the hill. The federal troops got under them and just shot them. Men, women, and children in the backs, dead. Hundreds. And that wasn't the end of it. Then the federal troops went up, and they started cutting up the Indians. They cut the scrotums off the men, the breasts off the women, and they made them into coin purses that turned out to be quite valuable within Eastern markets, and left what was remained of the corpses there to rot and to be eaten by the animals and the birds of the sky. The news of this, reporters were there. And they started sending out on the wire, this is what happened. And it just, for some reason, we've been treating the Native Americans like shit for years and years. But somehow, just this one event was enough. Way out there where no one had ever been before, that was enough. And suddenly it just snapped, and that was the end of it. And people started demanding and getting ugly about the way that the Natives were being treated. And it did lead to some reforms that were pretty important. Now, I bring up that story, first of all, to let you know a little bit about American history that you're never taught anymore. But I'm also bringing it up to tell you a story about how the snapping point happened in the 1920s. You see, even after the black market, when the Dow Jones collapsed so much in 1929, that really didn't cause a whole lot of concern. No, the story of the bankers jumped off buildings, that's a myth. No banker jumped off a building. But that was a catastrophe for investment, but it really didn't change anything. The country was still going to hell, and there was no change in the way the government was treating people. It was still pro-business, anti-labor, anti-poor people. They didn't see a problem. This is a market correction. It will take care of itself. If you've lost your life savings, well, that was your fault. Okay. Let's reel back to World War I, the Great War. The Great War, as I mentioned before, was sort of a phenomenal mix of medieval battle, medieval fighting, and modern fighting. And out of that war came an awful lot of American soldiers, veterans, who were crippled pretty badly. One thing, of course, was that this was a war where our enemy had used gas, releasing tanks of gas that wafted across the battlefield and settled into the trenches where our boys were sitting. And essentially, if it didn't kill them, it turned them into pathetic, half-lungless ghosts for the rest of their lives. Well, a lot of men came back in a lot of bad shape. Limbs missing, lungs just shot to hell. In other words, a lot of veterans came back and they couldn't find a damn job. Pretty much anywhere. No one wants a cripple. Well, these men had been promised a pension, but you don't get your pension until your old age. So there they were, suffering and starving. How the rumor got started is a matter of dispute. But somehow a rumor started among veterans of World War I, American veterans of World War I, that the Congress and the President were working on a little bonus for them that would get them through the 1920s, get them to the point where they could get their old age pension. And this bonus took on, this idea that there was going to be a bonus took on a life of its own. Now, the government claimed, no, we never made any kind of promise like that. And the veterans said, well, yeah, we, and there is some evidence that some senator actually did mention this possibility, maybe just at some political rally to gain some votes. Who knows? But it became a belief of the veterans that there was going to be a bonus and it was going to come any time, and that the Congress just had to pass the little legislation to get it going. Congress and the president had no intention. They were not going to do anything like that, but the veterans thought they were. You know, we're veterans. You know, everyone honors the veteran, and these are good men in Washington. They're going to take care of us. Well, the bonus didn't come, and it didn't come. And finally, some groups began to organize for a march on Washington. We were all going to get together, and all the veterans, and we're going to go to Washington. We're going to camp out in Washington, and we'll have our representatives talk with the president and the congressman, and we'll get this thing straightened out. There was no violence intended. We're just all going to go there and see Washington together. As a matter of fact, here in Illinois, there were several trainloads that were organized to pick up the veterans along the route on the way to Washington, D.C. Well, this bonus march, as it was came to be called, the bonus march started. And the bonus marchers all started heading to Washington, D.C., and they got there, and they pitched their tents. They pitched them on the White House lawn and everywhere around the White House lawn. You could do that in those days. They pitched tents just like the ones they had when they were soldiers in World War I, in the Great War. They had their little camping pots and they had their little fires going. It was just like an ocean of these. All these bonus marchers converged on Washington so that their representatives, so the president could look out his window and see, oh, these, here they are. Well, let's get this done now. As the commentator of the era, Will Rogers, said, I have never seen such a bunch of polite, crippled men in my life. He said something to that effect. And so it was that they were thinking, well, the president's going to see us and out his window, and we'll talk with some congressmen, we'll get this bonus taken care of, and then we'll all go back home. Well, the president didn't see it that way at all. He looked out his window, and more or less, he freaked. Oh my God, this is a revolution, or something like that. So he had his Secretary of War, he ordered his Secretary of War to get these bonus marchers out of Washington. Get them out. And the responsibility for doing this fell on a young hothead officer named George Patton, who would later become a quote-unquote hero of World War II. A movie was made about him, even though he was consistently one of the stupidest, most ignorant generals in American history. He ranks right up there with Custer and a few others as being an absolute moron. But there he was in charge of getting the bonus marchers off the lawn. Well, the morning came, and Patton lined up a cavalry regiment. Swords, firearms, the whole nine yards. People in Washington, D.C. thought there was a parade, a huge parade, and everyone was like, what kind of a parade didn't we hear about? This is cool. Look at this. This is a huge number of soldiers on horses. There was no parade. Patton was going to take care of the problem. And they lined up, and they charged with their swords drawn. Now, if you've ever seen a horse charge, it is terrifying. I had it happen to me in Columbus, Ohio, when a bunch of asshole policemen on horseback charged into a crowd of 4th of July revelers. It is phenomenally terrifying. You put that with swords, chopping and hacking. Men were running with in their underwear. Tents were just being destroyed right in place. It was a rout. The bonus marchers, crippled, hardly able to breathe, some of them without legs or arms, running, crawling, trying to get away from the horse beat. Down Pennsylvania Avenue and across several big streets towards the river, the horsemen chased the bonus marchers. And then at the river, across the bridge, the bonus marchers ran and Patton's troops stopped on the other side. The bonus marchers, exhausted, reconnoitered, got themselves together on that on their side of the bridge, figuring out what they were going to do next. Patton on his side. By this time, the newspapers were already starting, reporters were everywhere seeing this going on. And the news got back to the president, Herbert Hoover, that there was a big problem. Patton had really, really gone overboard. And so Hoover ordered a messenger to go to Patton and say, stop. Leave him alone now. It's over. Patton's assistant at the time told the story of what happened next. The messenger got to Patton, and the Patton just went into an insane rage. I don't take orders from a messenger. The assistant, by the way, was a young officer named Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower said Patton immediately ordered his troops to go across the bridge and lay siege. Well, at that point, hell broke loose. On the other side of the bridge, somehow fires started getting going. Fires everywhere. Now, the government said the bonus marchers were arsonists. They were setting fires. Locals said otherwise. They said there were firearms being shot and there were like incendiary things being thrown. One way or the other, again, a flashpoint in history happened. A house caught on fire, a big house, and there was a photographer right there. As the blaze consumed the house and a baby inside the house, the photographer got his shot. And that shot was all over the newspapers across the entire country within a matter of hours. And another flashpoint in history had occurred. You've screwed us and screwed us. You've lied. You've benefited the rich. You've handed them everything. You screwed our unions. You put us in prison for even trying to collectively bargain. Enough is enough. And so we began a new era. When the next election came, all of the old politicians were thrown out of office. The president and his party were thrown out on their ear. And a whole new way of governance with the people. Government actively involved in keeping the economy from getting too hot or too cold came about. The era of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Take a break, and I'll talk about unions in that era. In the 1932 presidential election, the rascals were thrown out. The country had had enough. It was a bad economic time. Usually we talk about recessions. Well, this was a depression. Unemployment had reached officially around a fourth of the labor force was unemployed. Unofficially, it was worse than that. You had all manner of just really bad times happening. It was grim, and it was just getting grimmer. Did any of you, there was a movie, I kind of like the way it depicted the life in the Great Depression. It was called Cinderella Man a few years back. You saw it, Russell Crowe. It was a true story of a boxer of the time. But just showing their lives, living it. Mom would have to fill the milk. There was a little bit of milk. She'd put water in it, water it down to have, so the kids would think they had a full bottle of milk and all that kind of stuff. It was rough. And it was rough in that way where, see, we had had bad recessions before that. In the 1800s, we were going through some pretty rough recessions. And there was a policy, the government had always had the policy, back from the time of Adam Smith, the government has no business helping an economy out of a recession. businesses will recover and jobs will come back in their own time. It's not the government's place to help an economy recover. And it had always been the rule. And that rule had been gone through the recessions in the 1800s and in the early 1900s. And the truth of the matter was that, yeah, the economy does recover, but the recessions had lasted for years in some cases, years and years, and they had essentially caused the country to fall backwards as far as its industrial capability. You have a recession go on long enough, buildings deteriorate, people lose their skills, capital goes to other places, and so the idea that just let the government stay out of this had finally run its course. And the Congress that was elected, the senators and the representatives and the president, were of a new breed. They were following the economic prescriptions of an economist named John Maynard Keynes. John Maynard Keynes, a British economist, said there is a place for the government, and it's an important place. When the economy is growing too slowly, the government should borrow money, it should print money, and get the economy going again, and lower taxes. And then when the economy is rolling really hot and fast, the government should pull back the money supply, the government should pay off its debts, and take care of, you know, getting its own house back in order. In other words, what we're talking about is a new kind of macroeconomic policy that is countercyclical. In other words, the government serves as a massive countercyclical agent. When the economy is doing badly, the government steps in. Jobs, money, food, you name it. And then when the economy is cooking good, you pull back all those extra federal jobs. You pull back on the benefits for unemployed workers. You pull back on the welfare stuff. You stop printing so much money. And you pay off all the bills that you gathered when you were doing the other side of it, helping out. Radical new policy. And, of course, you had back in that time, oh, this is just communism and all that. Big business interests were just screaming, squealing like pigs, but they couldn't do a whole lot because they were in a bad strait themselves. But you understand that I mentioned Karl Marx and his revolutionary calls. Workers of the world unite, overthrow the governments, destroy the businesses. The government owns all business, and everyone works for the government. The government provides everything. That's communism. And that model had already scored a major victory. In Russia, the monarchy had been overthrown, and a communist government was running Russia. And it would continue to do so until the 1990s. So the Reds had teeth. And if we did not pay attention to all these workers suffering what they were suffering, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia could come to the American shores, finally. So we had to do something that was going to ensure that people didn't turn to that kind of radicalism. But it was more than that, you see, because there was a competing philosophy that was becoming a political reality and a nightmare in Europe in the 1920s. A miserable, puky little lieutenant from World War I who was in prison came slithering out, and he was following the prescriptions of another German philosopher, the counter of Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche, who was, and this little twerp in the 1920s was gathering followers with a completely different message. It wasn't a communist message. He called it a socialist workers' party, but it was completely different from that. You see, his message was like this. Look, the problem is not that we need more government. We need more socialist, communist types of programs. I'll tell you what the problem is. You don't have jobs. Germany was in a shambles after World War I. You don't have jobs. I'll tell you why you don't have jobs. You don't have jobs because of all these damn immigrants. That's the problem. We don't have jobs because of all these Jews. We don't have jobs because of all these Catholics, these gypsies, these homosexuals. That's why we don't have jobs. You are an Aryan. Stop crawling on your knees. Rise up and take back your individual liberty. Pick up your gun and follow me. Rise above the masses. In other words, we're talking about Nazism. And the message was every bit as appealing then as it is now to these hillbilly rednecks here. Yeah, that's the problem. It's these immigrants pouring in and taking our country. It's these Jews conspiring with the communists to take over the Fed. Yeah, that's our problem. It's our society falling apart because of the mongrelization of our white race. That's the problem. Sound familiar? Well, it was working in the 20s in Europe pretty damn well, and it was beginning to take a hold in the United States too. You had, on the one hand, the communists saying, join the workers of the world and overthrow the government. Then you had these Nazis saying, join the individual libertarians of the world and fix this country. And so the 1930s, the government we had was trying to find a way to keep either of these two extremes from becoming too politically powerful. How do you do that? You get the people back to work. You make jobs. If there aren't jobs, you make jobs for them. If they don't have money, you just print money and give it to them. If necessary, finally, at the end of the day, if you need a damn war, then start one. But there you are. But anyway, and we came to a new era. Now, Roosevelt and his Congress were hell-bent on reform. We're going to reform the securities industry. We're going to reform the banking industry. No more of this crap with these banks playing all of these dirty games, mixing investment money with people's savings and all of that kind of stuff. So they passed a law called the Glass-Steagall Act to crack down on the banks that were screwing up so badly. The Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in 1999. Coincidence? To get the stock market industry back under control, they passed the Securities Act of 1933. That took care of new issues of stock and other securities. To take care of the secondary markets where stocks are traded back and forth, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 was passed. By the way, the Securities Act of 1933 also established, these two acts also created the Securities and Exchange Commission. In other words, a regulatory body, just like I was telling about, that would oversee that. Now, this was a pro-labor government. There was no question about it. We need people to have jobs, decent jobs at good wages, and no more of this crap with not just low wages, but with wretched working conditions, with kids working in factories, for God's sake. And also, one of the best ways that we can take care of this is not just by the government regulating workplace conditions, but also by letting labor unions have their play. We are going to stop these laws that forbid collective bargaining. We're going to make this go away so that unions can form, the workers can get together and negotiate, and the business owners have to talk to them. So we come to the National Industrial Relations Act of 1933. National Industrial Recovery Act. I said relations. Recovery Act. Duh. It gave unions the right to collectively bargain. In other words, it didn't give them, it recognized. In other words, a judge can't say you're in prison because you tried to collectively bargain, Mr. Union person. It was actually not all that strong. But this is where you see the effect of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court justices, the nine of them, are appointed over a period of time by different presidents. As a justice retires, another one is appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. So the Supreme Court is a long-tailed body of old philosophies of presidents far back. Like, for example, our current Supreme Court. It has several of its justices come from first Bush, a few from Clinton, several from the second Bush, and two from the current president. But, of course, what that meant was that Roosevelt and his Congress, their radical liberalism was not going to sit well with these justices at the Supreme Court because these cats had been appointed by a string of right-wing conservative presidents. So those nine justices were sitting there on the bench, and as soon as the National Industrial Recovery Act was challenged, it went to expedited review by the Supreme Court, which ruled it unconstitutional because it was in favor of unions and against big business. And these were justices that had been appointed by big business presidents. They just said it's unconstitutional. Nope, can't do it. And this is where Franklin Delano Roosevelt first showed his teeth. Supreme Court, you're talking about the Constitution, and we all want to respect the Constitution. Well, let's open up this Constitution here, and let's look at that place where it talks about the formation of the Supreme Court. Oh, wait a minute. There's no mention of how many Supreme Court justices there are. We've always had nine, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says there can't be 10, 20. Hell, I could appoint 100. I could pack the court with people who agreed with me. There's nothing in the Constitution that says I can't put as many Supreme Court justices as I want in that building of yours. And then your nine little voices would not matter anymore when it came to deciding whether my legislation was constitutional or unconstitutional. So Congress passed. Once this had been struck down by the Supreme Court, Franklin Delano Roosevelt made his statement about what he was going to do to the Supreme Court, and Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, which was actually a stronger act than the National Industrial Recovery Act. The National Labor Relations Act, I think it was 1935. You'll hear me refer to that. It's commonly referred to as the Wagner Act, from the name of the congressman who put the legislation forth. The Wagner Act not only gave workers the right to collectively bargain, gave unions the right to collectively bargain, it went down to the roots and said that people have the right to labor, to organize labor. Not only can the unions exist and bargain, there were laws that kept people from even meeting and talking about making a union. Those aren't here anymore. And it gave people the right to join a union. You could not have a business said you're not allowed to have be in a union. And it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found it constitutional. In other words, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, after the Supreme Court had smacked down the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, Roosevelt essentially asked the Supreme Court, who's your daddy? And the Supreme Court came back and said, you are. You see, the Supreme Court did not want Roosevelt to pack the court, and they knew damn well Roosevelt was just the kind of son of a bitch who would do it. There was other legislation, too. Roosevelt actually, the story goes, and I guess there are recordings of him saying this. He got a handwritten letter from a little girl who was saying she lived with her sister, and her sister worked at a job where she was paid so little that they couldn't even eat every day. Roosevelt actually had that handwritten letter in his hand when he made a declaration of a new law that he wanted Congress to pass where there would be a minimum wage. He said, what is it? This is the greatest country on earth, an industrialized nation, and we cannot guarantee a minimum wage for workers? Ain't going to happen anymore. This little girl's letter tells me that we need to pass a law. No business can pay less than a specific amount of money per hour to a worker. That was the first time a minimum wage was established in this country, a broad minimum wage. It has loopholes in it to this day. Congress has dilly-dallied around with letting it stay the same instead of letting it move with inflation. We're talking now about finally bringing it up again. The reality is, though, that, you know, it's never really kept up with inflation, but at least we have it in place. That was one of the things of the Roosevelt years. Worker safety laws. No children in industrial workplaces laws. All of that. The work hours. You're allowed, you can have a union. You might hate unions, but they're the reason you have these 8-hour work days. And you have places where you don't get killed in the workplace. And all of those kinds of things. The unions rolled during this period. Through the 1930s and the 1940s, the union movement gathered steam. The American Federation of Labor, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the Teamsters, they all came on. And they grew in power and size. And also, unfortunately, though, as often happens in politics, people forget. And by the time, even in World War II, by the time we're in 1943, 1944, people were beginning to elect Republicans back to Congress. We have short memories of what these people are about, and the pro-business interests began to gather force and power. Roosevelt passed on, and his successor, Truman, inherited an end of the war and then a post-war America where the lessons of the Great Depression were being forgotten. Prosperity was everywhere, was not everywhere, but there was prosperity. And when people are prosperous again, they forget about who was it who did this and who was it who made them unprosperous before the problems were fixed. And so by the time you get to the late 40s, you have powerful pro-business interests buying their way back into Congress. And you began to see anti-union legislation starting to take hold. You also saw other attacks on unions. Don't get me wrong. Unions were getting tremendously corrupt. Organized crime had penetrated unions. Violence that was just beyond appalling was part of the union reality. And by the time you get to 1947, there was enough of an anti-union backlash in Congress that we got another era in 1947, the first blowback, the Taft-Hartley Act. The National Labor Relations Act, it was called, I believe. No. It was called the Management Labor Relations Act. That was its official name. Act of 1947. It was a blowback, an anti-union blowback. A couple of things, hallmarks. First of all, it allowed states to pass what are called right-to-work laws. In other words, any state could pass a law so that you didn't have to belong to a union to get a job. Illinois has a right-to-work law. They are usually, when you hear a right-to-work law, it sounds like a really positive thing, but it's actually pro-business, anti-labor. It also prohibited the closed shop. The closed shop. Now, a closed shop is a company where you can't get a job unless you are a union member. That's a closed shop. A closed shop is a company where you can't have a job there unless you're a union member. It made those illegal. It did not make illegal, though, what are called union shops. Now, a union shop, you can get a job and not be a part of a union, but eventually you have to join a union. So in other words, let me give you an example. There are businesses here in town where you can get a job there without being a member of a local union, some local chapter of a union, but they've got like a clock within 3 years you have to join the union. That's a union shop. Those are legal, but it's illegal to make it so that it's a requirement to get the work to be in the closed shop, to be there. Now, Taft-Hartley also prohibited unions from having jurisdictional disputes. In other words, where they would fight with each other over some who was in control of some turf. Interestingly, it prohibited sympathy strikes and secondary boycotts. Taft-Hartley prohibited sympathy strikes and secondary boycotts. Okay, now a sympathy strike. I'll give you an example. Here, some years back at this fine community college, while they were building that building over there, that Workforce Development Center, the local union was talking about going on strike because they said there was unfair negotiations going on for the pay. Now, if they had gone on strike, I, as a member of the American Federation of Teachers, my union could not engage a strike in sympathy with them. However, I could refuse to cross the picket line, and they couldn't fire me if I said, my brothers have a picket line, and I will not cross that picket line. In other words, I am not, as an AFT union man, doing a sympathy strike, but I am going to respect their picket line. So the sympathy strike is forbidden, but you can still not cross the picket line as another union person. The secondary boycott. There's an interesting story here that's actually playing itself out right now. I could not say, all right, my brothers in the Teamsters are on strike, so I, as a member of another union, will not buy products that would be provided by Teamster labor. That'd be a secondary boycott. In other words, my union can't call for a boycott of products that are the subject of a labor dispute by another union. That's a secondary boycott. Interestingly enough, there are several powerful conservative groups that are saying Taft-Hartley could be applied to regular people who call for boycotts of products of companies they don't approve of. In other words, I don't like Monsanto's practices, so I'm calling for a boycott of all Monsanto Frankenfood. These conservative scholars are saying that they want to see these people sued because technically they're calling for a secondary boycott, which is illegal under Taft-Hartley. Now, how far they would get? That's scary. It depends on what the Supreme Court looks like when that case gets there. As the Supreme Court is now, there's a good chance the Supreme Court could say, yes, throw those people in prison who called for secondary boycotts. Okay, now, Taft-Hartley also did one other thing. It gave the president the power to call for an 80-day cooling-off period in a labor dispute. In other words, if you have a labor dispute, a union is striking, the company is doing a lockout of the workers, and it's having some national effect, the president can say, everyone stops this bickering. Workers, go back to work. Company, unlock the doors for 80 days under that time period during which the offices of the executive branch of the United States will oversee getting the sides to talk and get things worked out. The last time this was called, the president invoked Taft-Hartley was President Bush. I think it was 2005. There was a dock strike on the West Coast, the Teamsters against the dock owners, and there was all this stuff being shipped in from Asia. It was just stacking up on the docks for weeks and weeks. And so President Bush called for essentially cooling off period. All of you, knock it off. Because you're disrupting supplies into the rest of the country with this fight of yours. And interestingly enough, by the time 80 days were over, it was resolved. So it's not a horrible thing, this 80-day cooling off period, because sometimes it takes a good kick in the seat of the pants to both sides to get them to stop their intransigence. Okay. Union tactics. Starting with the mildest one. Actually, there's one of the PowerPoints I didn't put in there. Just fussing and bitching. Okay, you know, I don't like working conditions, blah, blah, blah. Collectively bargain. But then you get to essentially your classical, okay, our contract is expiring. We're going to have a negotiation for a new contract. We work out the wages, working conditions, health benefits, all those kinds of things. That's a typical negotiation. Now, in big industries where you have only a few companies against one or two unions, you'll have something called pattern bargaining. Pattern bargaining. In the auto industry, this is very common. Essentially, our union contract, United Auto Workers, our contract with Ford is coming up this year, as it is with several others soon after that, GM, Chrysler, whatever. So you're the Ford people. Okay, we are going to ignore negotiations with the other big automakers, and we're going to negotiate with you. We're going to focus on you. You screw with us, we're just going to go out and strike. You're dead. They're still building cars. So you're going to talk to us, and we're going to get a really nice agreement out of you. Once we do that, that becomes a pattern. Okay, we've got an agreement with them. This is what we got from them. You're going to do the same, right? And once you figure out that you're screwed, they don't care about you anymore, you're sitting over there in the corner cowering, we've got you, and then we come to you, who's your daddy, please sign. That's pattern bargaining, okay? Other ways that it can go. If you've got a labor dispute going on, businesses have a lot of power. They can lock you out. They can just lock out the workers. There's a company not far in this area of the country, Hormel, that locked out its workers many, many years ago, ruined their lives just because they wanted a decent wage. So you got a lockout on the part of a company. That's a big one. Now, on the side of the workers, on the union side, you've got the first one is a work slowdown. A work slowdown. Essentially, you're not walking out of, you're not striking or anything like that. You're just taking your sweet old time getting things done around the office or around the factory. It's just like a little warning shot. Then the next step, if that one doesn't work, is what's called a work stoppage. It's not a strike. You simply, at 1 o'clock, we are going to walk out for 1 hour just to let you know what this place sounds like when there's no one here. Oh, it's quiet. Gee, you're not making any money because no products are being made. That's a work stoppage. I was in a work stoppage several times. It's actually kind of scary because what's going to happen? Are they going to let us back in? Well, yeah, they did, but they were pissed, and you know, it's just one of the tactics. Then you have a trick that comes from the New York City Police Union. It's called the Blue Flu. The Blue Flu. Before contract negotiations start for a new contract with the New York Police, they were the ones who, I think they invented it, Irish bastards that they are. In the weeks leading up to the negotiations, there will be a day when about a third of the policemen will call in sick. Sick today, I just can't come to work. Well, they'll show up the next day, but that next day, another third of the police will call, I'm sick, I think I've got the flu today. So the next day, they all show back up to work, and then the other third of the police call in sick. I feel terrible today. And they just keep doing this so that on any given day, a third of the cops aren't on the beat, and so the party begins with the rapes, robberies, murders, and other cat stranglers running around amok because a third of the cops aren't on duty. And after a while, the politicians in New York get the message, oh, I guess they have us by what is generally referred to as the spherical taters, and so we have to negotiate in good faith. That's Blue Flu, okay? Now, there are other tactics leading up to the strike. The strike is you just stop working and you are not going to work again until a contract favorable, voted on by the union membership, recommended by the union bosses, has been put on the table. We're not going to work. We're going to shut you down. A strike. Now, here's the other side. Businesses. Counter strategies. First one, as I mentioned, lock out. A company can just lock out the workers. You think you can stand up to us? We'll just lock you out. See how you like it without a paycheck. How long are you going to survive? Those union strike funds aren't going to last worth shoot, and you are going to be starving. So we're going to just lock you out until you learn who's boss. Lockout. Other methods, scabs. Scabs are people that are hired by the company when the workers are on strike. I'm on strike, a scab is hired. Now, I've seen scabs in my time. I've slashed their tires in my time. I shit you not. In teaching, there was a school where they brought in substitute teachers when we were on strike, and damned if those substitute teachers didn't have real problems with the tires. Scabs. They are the scum of the earth, but they were.
Scabs, is that what you call them?
No, they are called scabs. That's
kind of bias.
Well, yeah, I slashed their tires. They deserved it, for Christ's sake. God damn. They were busting my strike.
God forbid
they're the one to eat. Yeah, I mean, damn their souls. You know, they can get a job. Not mine. I didn't break their windows. Some of the guys were hotheads. They smashed windows. I thought that was inappropriate when they smashed the windows of the people's play houses. But anyway, I know, right? Welcome to the world of labor unions. I mean, it's a knockdown, drag-out world. We're losing right now. Labor union participation has been falling since the 1950s. Unions have been broken. Now, one of the let me give you a couple of others. Businesses can get legislation passed that's anti-union legislation, Taft-Hartley. Businesses can use law enforcement for harassment and Congress. In the 1950s, there was the House Un-American Activities Committee, which destroyed many, many lives because the head of the committee, one Joe McCarthy, was dragging in people, actors, writers, musicians, union people, and accusing them of being communists. That ruined their lives, destroyed them. Joe McCarthy did that. It was called the Communist Scare. It was the era in which he stood up as the perfect American. It was the era when you had the Pledge of Allegiance, but to show how pious he and his fellow people were in Congress, they put God into the Pledge of Allegiance. It had never been there before. And they passed all kinds of pro-religious legislation, wrecked a lot of people's lives. Some people went to prison, actors and actresses, musicians. One musician who had made an interesting song called Strange Fruit about all the black people who were lynched in the South all the time was dragged before this committee, and Joe McCarthy demanded that he admit that he had been paid to write this song by communists and Jews. Anyway, so union activity has been dropping since then. In 1981, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, after years of very difficult working conditions as air traffic controllers, long hours, low pay, they struck. President Ronald Reagan fired all of them. By executive order, he fired all of the union members who were on strike. That's about the biggest thing you can do. That was pretty much the death knell of unions. Unions have never gotten their mojo back after that, because what can you do when the president can just end a strike by firing everyone? I mean, that's sort of like the end of it. There are unions still around today, but they are pretty much just political organizations. They'll pay money to both sides just to get what they want. Another one that's also kind of popular and has been for many years is where businesses will essentially have their own union candidates. Whenever there are elections for presidents of the union and all the executives of the union, you'll have all these tough people saying, I want to be the president, I want to. Well, businesses will make sure that they are paying under the table someone or some group to pretend that they are all in favor of the union, but they're actually the businesses people posing as union people wanting to run the union. That's out there, as are a number of other tactics that are used by unions. There's anti-union propaganda. There's pro-union propaganda. And it's in a balance right now. Like I said, unions are losing ground. Their membership has collapsed. The peak was in the 1950s, and it's been falling ever since. It's barely worth mentioning in some industries anymore. In other industries, they're still powerful. But there you go. That's all I have for you. Go home.